Welcome, everyone, to the Cardio Seeds podcast. I'm Dr. Svetlana Shimon, your host. Today, we will explore the present and future of American healthcare, discussing ways to optimize the system and improve the well-being of medical professionals. So, if you are with us, let's dive right in and begin this exciting journey together. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Cardio Seeds podcast. This episode is a part of our special 2024 Lifestyle Medicine series, where we feature members of the American College of Lifestyle Medicine. I'm your host, Dr. Svetlana Shimon, CEO of Cardio Seeds. Before we get started with our great guest today, I have a brief message for you, as I always do. My new book called Resilience in Scrubs, Thriving as a Woman Resident Physician is available now on Amazon in Kindle and paperback. As you know, I wrote this book as a self-help guide for women physicians who are in the early stages of their medical careers. It's a wonderful guide book to have for any women starting their medical careers. It's packed with important information every female physician needs: navigating gender dynamics, salary negotiations, leadership, mentorship, personal and professional wellness, burnout prevention, family and financial planning. You will find it all inside this book. I even included self-care tools with exercise, breathing techniques, meditation, mindfulness, and healthy recipes, and so much more. So it's a one-step reference for all your needs, wellness needs as a young female physician or a medical student for that matter. So please check it out on Amazon. It makes a great gift. Please recommend it to your colleagues and friends and leave reviews on Amazon. We really need it and we greatly appreciate it. And the title is Resilience in Scrubs, Thriving as a Woman Resident Physician. And with that, let's get started. And we have a great guest with us today as a part of our Cardio Seeds podcast, American College of Lifestyle Medicine 2024 series. Annika Linfitt is a fourth year medical student at Michigan State University College of Human Medicine, and she will be graduating this May. She is pursuing a combined residency in internal medicine and pediatrics at the University of North Carolina starting this June. Annika used to serve as a trainee vice president of communications through the American College of Lifestyle Medicine, and she is a recipient of the 2024 Donald Pegg Student Leadership Award through the American College of Lifestyle Medicine. Annika has vast career interests, and she's looking forward to exploring them throughout her residency. And she has a hope that she'll be able to bring her understanding for holistic patient care and passion for evidence-based medicine into her career as a physician, with the goal of practicing her true health care, not just sick care. So with no further delays, Annika, welcome to the Cardio Seeds podcast. It's my pleasure and honor to have you on today.
Yes, thank you so much, Lana, for having me. It's really great to be here, and I'm looking forward to talking to you about lifestyle medicine.
Absolutely. Annika, so, you know, this year, I basically ask all my ACLM guests pretty much similar questions, or, you know, questions rotating around the same topics. With you, though, as still a person in training, or a woman specifically, you know, in training, or a young woman going into medicine, I wanted to modify them a little bit to those specifics. And my first question would be actually about your choices, specifically going and choosing lifestyle medicine so early, or not so much lifestyle medicine as a choice, but focusing your, you know, your attention on lifestyle medicine. You were a trainee vice president with the American College of Lifestyle Medicine, so you noticed this specialty so early in your medical training. It had appealed to you. Why? And what's your niche within lifestyle medicine in the future? How you see yourself within this domain as you're going to immerse yourself into your future training in the realm of internal medicine and pediatrics?
Yeah, really great question. And I think a lot of us, when we discover lifestyle medicine, or at least when we discovered it for the first time, it was kind of what led us to wanting to discover that it existed in the first place. So when I first became interested in what lifestyle medicine is, I didn't even know that the American College of Lifestyle Medicine existed. I viewed what I now understand as lifestyle medicine within the scope of preventive medicine. And while they are, you know, related in some ways, they are also very different, with preventive medicine being more on a public health atmosphere and lifestyle medicine being more focused on patient care. So when I first became interested in lifestyle medicine was after my dad passed away when I was 20. So a long time ago, prior to even starting medical school, I had experience from the other side of healthcare, and I realized that there was so much that we were missing and what we were not doing for patients that could help them in the long term with their morbidity and their mortality and just their day-to-day well-being. And so when I was accepted into medical school and I had this understanding and this personal experience that I had gone through, I knew that it was something that I wanted to be involved with or to create within my medical school. So I started searching just the general concepts of preventive medicine, and that's what led me to the American College of Lifestyle Medicine. And that's how I found out that the ACLM as a whole existed. And I'm so thankful that it did, because I was able to create the first lifestyle medicine interest group at Michigan State. And I have done a lot since then to help try to further it, but we can talk about that a little more later too. And when it comes to what I see as my niche in lifestyle medicine, I do, like I said, have a vast array of interests, which is why I'm doing both internal medicine, the care of adults, and pediatrics, the care of children. But regardless of whether I stay as a generalist, as a primary care doctor, or if I specialize, I do think that my passion is in lifestyle medicine advocacy and education within medical curricula. So that's what I view as being my niche, while also having the passion about lifestyle medicine to counsel my patients just on a day-to-day basis.
Wow. This is, you know, like when you told me about your dad just now, I never knew that, even though I know you from before, and I'm grateful to you, you know, for inviting me to present to your lifestyle medicine interest group that you created, you organized at your medical school. But everyone within the realm of lifestyle medicine, seems to me that everyone has a story to tell. And you have your story about your dad. And this is what triggered the interest in you. So tell me about your dad. And in retrospect, what you think he could have done differently Because you, with this, you know, knowledge now, the you know, all this newly acquired knowledge that you have with you now, what would you told him in the past? How would you modify his life? And would you think, what would you think he could have done differently to change his life, to improve his survivorship?
So I think, you know, in terms...
I'm very sorry, actually, that you lost him so early. Sorry.
It is interesting because, you know, at the time, I was only 20 years old. I hadn't even graduated college yet. I still feel I was very naive in my perspectives about the world and life in general. And so it has been an interesting experience looking back at it with the new knowledge that I have gained in medical school, because it makes me view the situation in a way I don't think I would have had the insight to had I not gone through medical education. But it's interesting because my dad did not die of what you initially think of when you think of lifestyle medicine related disease. He did not have diabetes. He did not have high blood pressure. He was not obese. So all in all, he actually was a really, you know, seemingly healthy person. He had a really excellent job. He was a banker. He worked in the same bank, Chase Bank, for over 20 years in a very high stress career. But he was a bike rider. He loved to walk in the woods. He was very outdoorsy and very active.
Stress.
Yes, stress. But the kicker with that is that he, while he didn't have, you know, your normal lifestyle medicine related disease, he did have autoimmune issues. So he had alopecia that he had in his late 20s. He had psoriasis. He had problems with his digestive system that he actually didn't have ever diagnosed. And then he likely had some other things going on underneath the surface that just did not manifest themselves until he became too sick to treat anything anymore. And so what that made me realize is, well, he had most of the pillars of lifestyle medicine. He was physically active. He tried to eat a well-rounded diet. He slept well every night. He was in a very high-stress career. And because of his autoimmune tendencies, he had to eliminate certain foods that didn't sit well with him and things like that. So I think in his scenario, had he had a really good and stable primary care doctor who had the knowledge about how lifestyle relates to our overall health, I think he may have had a lot of his underlying issues treated earlier before they started to spiral out of control. Why about lifestyle medicine? Because I think that anybody, whether you're a generalist or a specialist, can make a change in somebody's life with this information.
Let's take a quick break and announce that my new book titled Resilience in Scrubs, Thriving as a Woman Resident Physician is now available on Amazon in Kindle and paperback formats. It's really a self-help book for women physicians. It's packed with valuable toolkits and resources on a variety of topics from gender dynamics, resilience and wellness, salary negotiations, work life and family integration, embracing leadership roles, exploring career pivots, personal wellness, and much, much more. It makes a great gift to any woman physician you may know. So please, please check out on Amazon. The title is Resilience in Scrubs, Thriving as a Woman Resident Physician. And the best part is that I will donate all the proceeds from the sales of this book back to the American College of Lifestyle Medicine to support new members, resident members of the American College of Lifestyle Medicine. And we cannot do it without you. Thank you so much for your support. So what did eventually happen to him? How did he die?
So it was all very sudden. He, I think, looking back on it now, was starting to develop autoimmune disease of the lung, or what's called IPF, or idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis. And he got a virus, and that virus essentially caused him to have ARDS, or acute respiratory distress syndrome. And that's what he died from. But I also think he had a bunch of other underlying autoimmune disease. So his adrenals weren't working properly, and you need your adrenals and your stress response to heal from an injury like ARDS. So we didn't end up, you know, pursuing an autopsy, and we don't know exactly what ended up happening. I wish we would have, but that's what I suspect was happening looking back on it with, you know, this new knowledge that I have, which is a blessing and a curse, because it can be reassuring at times, but also frustrating at times too.
Well, now you know a lot. Now you're going to, you know, to your residency. You're going to talk to start talking to your patients as an MD, freshly minted MD. You're going to, you know, accumulate patients following. You're going to talk to them, you know, equipped with evidence-based, with randomized studies, you know, with good literature. Tell me about those studies that you're going to leverage treating your patients, consulting your patients, and what you're going to actually tell them, what literature you're going to give them to back your statements as a lifestyle medicine professional, lifestyle medicine physician.
Yeah. And that's a great question. And I think it's an important question, because I think lifestyle medicine as a field is very unique because it's multidisciplinary. So it doesn't encompass only physicians, MD or DOs. It also includes advanced practice providers. It includes dietitians, physical therapists. A lot of people who are interested in lifestyle medicine do have the capability of becoming board certified. And so I think it's important to ensure the field as a whole has a continuously growing base of evidence-based research, so that all of us, everyone in the multidisciplinary team, has something to fall back on instead of relying on social media or the internet or just lay knowledge to make recommendations to our patients. And so I think historically, you know, kind of the holy grail of lifestyle medicine that a lot of people are interested in was the China study by Colin Campbell. And while that was an excellent study and was important in spearheading the field of lifestyle medicine, because it essentially said that those who were living with a plant-based diet had less chronic disease burden. But while that was a very fascinating study, what makes research valid amongst the medical community is when studies are repeated and they show the same results. And so then they're able to build and they can say, look, it wasn't just this one study, 50, I don't remember when exactly the China study was, however many years ago, that said that a plant-based diet reduces chronic disease burden, but we have these hundreds of randomized controlled trials that also say the same thing.
It's called reproducible results.
Yes. Results. And then once you have X amount of randomized control trials, then you get to the stage where you're able to perform meta-analyses, and then your research is even more valid and your evidence-based recommendations to patients are even more true. So I think at this point, and before we came on here, I actually did a quick lit search on PubMed, my favorite evidence-based website, to see what was out there currently. And if you type in lifestyle medicine into PubMed, there are 60,000 results, which is a lot, but they span from 1975 to 2024. And a lot of them are still pretty broad. So for example, this one is in the Journal of Endocrinology, Lifestyle Medicine and the Future of Chronic Disease Management. And a lot of them kind of cover what lifestyle medicine could be, because there isn't enough research yet to really say that all of these things are truly evidence-based in the definition of, you know, the medical community. So I think as of now, I rely on studies like, you know, the Mediterranean diet and how it reduces metabolic syndrome, and the DASH diet and cessation of alcohol and how it helps with blood pressure, and the utilization of lifestyle behaviors and reversal of type 2 diabetes. These are studies that have shown that lifestyle interventions can drastically influence our health. But what we need is more to prove to the medical community, to the overarching medical community, that these recommendations are truly evidence-based. But that's a challenge.
How do you see these studies being designed? Because lifestyle interventions design is notoriously difficult to conduct. I see the studies being designed in parallel, perhaps with medication design, incorporating them into drug trial design as a parallel limb or adjacent, you know, intervention to see additional benefit. So I don't see really, you know, for instance, a meditation study going head to head, you know, as a comparison to something else, to the drug or to something else. They need to be added on as an additional, you know, intervention and compared to the arm without that intervention. So how do you see the design?
And this is where I think the challenge lies. Mm-hmm. There are so many factors that contribute to lifestyle that are almost impossible to control for. So for example, if you wanted to do a long-term randomized control trial on the benefits of a plant-based diet on X disease, you would also have to be sure that each patient within the cohort had similar levels of stress, had similar levels of sleep, had similar levels of physical activity, and all of these things that play a role in our just general wellness, to really say that it was the nutrition intervention that played a role. And so I do think it's a challenge. I do know in the past, there have been studies, I think mostly mental health, where many of the patients have been hospitalized in a facility where they have employed a nutrition arm and then a placebo arm. And at the end, they see, you know, what are their scores in depression, anxiety, et cetera. And they've seen great results with that from patients who are in the whole food plant-based arm versus placebo. But not a lot has been done in the general community. And that's
right. Those are a little bit artificial environments. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, even if you implement a nutrition arm or a physical activity arm, you really have to make sure that the patients are doing it. And so it all poses a lot of challenge. And I think that's what the ACLM is grappling with currently, is just how to conduct this research efficiently and adequately to make sure that the results are valid.
Maybe those sensors that are, you know, artificial intelligence and sensors will come handy, that will collect information, you know, wearables, et cetera, et cetera. But maybe even ingestibles, something like capsules that will collect information around the clock, not only about the digestible things, but about the mood effect and stuff like that. Because when we don't think about collecting the data in our diaries and stuff like that, we need to be completely unbiased while collecting data.
Yeah.
So wearables and digestible capsules, et cetera, patches will be playing more and more role.
I am by no means an expert in artificial intelligence, but I do think that it is going to play a massive role in a lot of medical technology within the next, you know, few years, even decade. So I think the ACLM will be able to kind of capitalize on that, and hopefully we can use it to our advantage for efficient research.
So what research is still needed, in your opinion, in the realm of lifestyle medicine?
I think, kind of just going off of what I was saying before, research is needed really in every area, not to prove that lifestyle medicine is effective, but to confirm and to be able to prove that it's effective to the overarching medical community, who might not be on board with what the ACLM is and what we're trying to say. Because as we know, there are a lot of confounding factors within the medical community, with pharmaceuticals and other entities that are competing with the values of ACLM.
Mm-hmm.
I think in general, research mostly just needs to be done to confirm what we already kind of know.
In other words, we need some sort of, you know, a set of guidelines. We need to standardize our research and our approach in lifestyle medicine, not just be all over the place. We need to a set of standard care rules and regulations in this, because we base our standard everyday Western medicine on a set of guidelines, right? So this is XYZ prescription are based on a set of guidelines, standard research. The same thing has to be in lifestyle medicine. We cannot be just, you know, basing it on a, you know, a random approach. Yeah.
That brings up a whole different conversation of, you know, we have standardized guidelines when it comes to medicinal management of this,
mm-hmm.
but we have ways to help patients pay for that. So we have insurance that helps patients to be able to follow those guidelines.
Of course, by the same token. Yeah.
Whereas with lifestyle interventions, a lot of that falls on the personal ability of the patient, their financial access to a whole food plant-based diet, to a gym, to things that keep them socially connected, their ability to sleep 8 hours a night, their stress levels. A lot of that is on the, you know, patient's side. So I think a lot also needs to be done on the advocacy level to help patients to be able to have access to these things that allow them to live a healthy lifestyle.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The American College of Lifestyle Medicine, our scientific college, our leadership, to maximize the benefit to our patients, to our community, what role should the American College of Lifestyle Medicine play in the field of this wellness, of the research in the next 5 to 10 years? What's the role of the college, in your opinion?
I think currently the main focus of the ACLM has been the how. How do we incorporate lifestyle medicine into modern Western medicine practices? So, in other words, how can doctors or anyone else who is certified to practice, how can they practice lifestyle medicine and get compensated for it? So I think a lot of the current focus is on the business of lifestyle medicine. And I think they've done a lot of excellent things to figure out how people can do that with direct primary care models, with value-based care models, a lot of different things that help lifestyle medicine to become viable. But I think what needs to be done next, and as I touched on a little bit earlier, is advocacy at both national and state levels regarding lifestyle medicine. Because like I said, a lot of the interventions that lifestyle medicine is able to employ also require patient participation and patient access. So, for example, in pediatrics, there's a huge epidemic of pediatric obesity that is leading to childhood onset type 2 diabetes, hypertension, kidney disease, things that you typically wouldn't even see until you're in your later adulthood. Kids are now struggling with. But how can we effectively help these kids with lifestyle medicine if they don't have access to adequate green space, if they have school lunches that consist of pizza and hot dogs and french fries and chips, or if they live in an environment that is stressful? And I think...
Or if their families are not just buying into the whole idea of education or transitioning to healthy lifestyles, right?
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. That's even worse. It's even worse if the families aren't supportive. You cannot quit smoking if your partner is smoking, the household is smoking. The same with the kids. The most vulnerable age when the families are eating junk, sorry to say. That's, yeah.
Yeah, and so part of that is societal. Living in food deserts, not having financial access to healthy foods. But some of it, like you said, is just basic education and knowledge. And so I think that is part of the advocacy component that I would like to see grow within the ACLM. And that needs to be done at a community level first, and then can grow bigger to the state and national level. But at the community level, I think it comes down to providing education within schools, within churches, within places of work, to the general community so that they understand and know about the interventions that the ACLM is trying to.
What about our own health and wellness as physicians, as healthcare professionals, as a broader category? What can they do to enhance this part? I mean, you are, you know, going into medicine as a female physician, right? And women in medicine is a special category. You know, I care a lot about advocating for women physicians, for women physician wellness. It's the weakest link, to be frank, you know, to say the least. And we have to start early. We have to advocate. We have to educate. We have to really invest lots of our resources, lots of money, frankly, into this wellness of our healthcare, you know, trainees, women trainees specifically, starting with very, very early stages of education. What can ACLM do in that regard?
I think, so what can ACLM do, or what can we do as individuals?
Both. We will talk about ACLM first, and then we will talk about us as individuals. What do you think about ACLM first? I mean, of course, they can create educational programs. They can, you know, create perhaps member interest groups, do some webinars, publish things like this, perhaps create toolkits. We are creating, actually, I am a part of creating the wellness toolkit for resident physicians at the moment. But it just feels so little. It feels to me as a person with 30 plus years of experience in medicine, somehow it feels so little. I'm not sure why. Not sure why. Maybe I'm just overreacting, but maybe not. I think we just have to go broad. My feeling is, Annika, that every medical school has to have a member interest group. Every medical school has to invest into lifestyle medicine education. Every nursing school, every school that has something to do with healthcare education has to have a lifestyle medicine program and healthcare wellness program on the most robust level possible. And for female physicians, we have to have mentorship programs, leadership programs, propelling us to the top, holding us together. And it's not only American women, physician association or whatever, medical association. It's more than that. We have to have it on institutional level. We have to have it on personal level. We have to make connections. We should not be, working in silos and turning our back to one another and just finishing our workday and just going home and doing our, making our salads in the kitchen. We should just walking this life, walking this life and this professional personal life as a family and helping one another, not only to make a diagnosis of mitral valve prolapse, at work, but making this life better and easier and brighter to one another on a daily basis.
Yeah. And I think those are all really great points. And I think it also highlights, while the ACLM is doing a whole lot of good, it also kind of uncovers what could be done better. Because like I said earlier, the ACLM is very broad because it's multidisciplinary, not just amongst physicians. It spans across multiple different professional domains, and then within medicine itself, across every single medical specialty. And so when you want to create something that will cause lasting change, you need a solid group of people who are dedicated to the cause of continuing to forward the movement. And so I think we're on the way, but it's taken longer because the scope was so vast instead of the scope being a little more narrowed. So I think you make a great point in terms of medical education and also residency curriculum that the ACLM is trying to do. So for example, with residencies, they have the lifestyle medicine residency curricula. It's mostly in family medicine residencies right now. It's gone to a couple of internal medicine and pediatrics residencies, but compared to the total amount of residency programs in the country, it's hardly scratched the surface of reach. And then in terms of medical education, they've been starting to try to work with medical schools to create actual curricula that can be implemented into what is already being taught. But this comes with a lot of pushback because there are a set amount of things that medical students need to learn in their first 2 years in order to pass their first board exam. So how much wiggle room really can be created for this robust amount of information that needs... And so what that...
I was thinking a lot about this. In retrospect, when you look at medical school curriculum, maybe at some point it can be restructured. And maybe at some point physicians will start their specialization earlier. And whatever we learn in medical school can be restructured and regrouped into the specialty, you know, modules. So if you don't need ophthalmology, you don't study the eye. I mean, as as you know, I mean, maybe I'm just putting it in a very kind of coarse way, but I'm just generalizing. But this is how it's going to be, you know, because you cannot be going to medical school for 15 years because things are getting more and more complex. The amount of information, I think, is doubling now every 7 days or something like that. Yeah. Basically, that's the bottom line.
There are going to be a lot of drastic changes in medical education over the next decade with step one, the first USMLE exam going pass fail. There's going to be a lot more flexibility with medical schools to teach the curricula that they want to teach, as opposed to having to hit every single learning objective that the USMLE test students on, because now you simply just need to pass the test. And while it is incredibly important to have that base of medical knowledge and just facts floating in your head for when you're an attending doctor and a resident doctor, it's also important to have the baseline knowledge of what health really is. And I do think schools are starting to see that, and medical students are starting to see that. And so I do envision a lot of change happening over the next decade or two.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I want to ask you a couple more questions related to women in medicine. My passion, the subject I'm really interested in. The landscape of medicine is ever evolving, yet women in medicine always face unique challenges and expectations. And as you are prepared to step into the realm of residency, right, what perspectives do you bring, or what changes do you hope to see in the way female medical professionals are supported and recognized within the medical community?
Yeah. And I do think the more I've learned and the more time that has gone on throughout medical school, the more I realize the unique challenges that we as women face. And I think a lot of that, and this is talking in, you know, general binary terms, but as women, most of us have a lot of inherent qualities that attune to the emotional needs of others and often multitask on many different things at the same time and are just very engaged emotionally, physically in the work that they are doing in that moment. And so I think burnout is an especially challenging thing for females, because while you are giving it your all during the day to your patients and to your work, if you go home and you have a family, if you have children, if you have a spouse, if you have other things that are on your plate, you are not only emotionally challenged at work, you are now also emotionally and physically challenged at home. And I think this is why so many women end up going part-time or just stopping work altogether, because it is so hard to balance both emotional burdens. And that is something that I'm grappling with now, because I'm realizing that the way I engage with patients and the way I emotionally interact with colleagues, and while I am at a shift in the hospital, is pretty similar to how I interact with my family and my friends. And so I'm exhausted by the end of the day.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the work you are doing is really important to bring a lot of this, you know, to the surface about how women really face these unique challenges. But I think that's where a lot of it comes from. It's just the innate need and the innate personality traits of nurturing and emotional availability that women have.
Mm-hmm. Women physicians are extremely unique. And I talk about this a lot in this book. And, you know, the phenomenon that you mentioned is called a double shift syndrome. When we do a shift at work and then we come home and do another shift at home, taking care of our families, taking care of our loved ones, frequently of our children, et cetera, et cetera. So it seems to never end, this, so, you know, circle of work, 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 at work and at home. So it's a double shift. So the thing is that burnout is much more prevalent, as well as anxiety and depression, in female physician population than in men. I talk a lot about burnout prevention as well. And I actually am on working with the publisher, Healthy Learning, on my next book's manuscript now, about the thriving as a woman physician from residency through retirement. And I will be making a very large chapter on burnout prevention and self-care in that very book throughout the lifespan of a woman physician. So I'm really putting a lot of work into this, extremely important. But as far as you now, I know that we are all vulnerable to those things that you mentioned. How do you work through those things, maintain your personal wellness? What are your habits now that you have developed to ensure your own mental and physical health? You know, so you don't take a back seat during those demanding phases of your life and medical career, but just, you know, you do the best for yourself.
Yeah, I think a lot of it certainly takes a lot of self-discipline. And I'm very thankful to have had a family and parents who kind of instilled a lot of the pillars of lifestyle medicine into me as a young child, even though that wasn't what they thought they were doing. They were just encouraging I live a healthy life. And a lot of those habits have persisted through my adulthood. And I think that's why so many kids struggle, because they weren't given those tools from an early age to grow into a healthy adult who can cope and who can use the tools they learned to be successful. And so I think for me, while it can be really hard when you're working a 12-hour shift, a 14-hour shift, a weekend, only having one day off per week, to really keep these lifestyle behaviors going at a consistent pattern, when you have that self-discipline from an early age, it really helps. So for example, I feel terrible if I don't exercise every day. And I have a dog who requires a lot of exercise. So I'm making it a point to walk my dog to at least get 30 minutes of exercise per day. And then I think another thing that's very important to me is I noticeably feel worse when I eat hospital food, or when I snack on the candy in the office or the donuts that somebody brought in that day. And so I try to make an effort to prepare my lunch in advance, something healthy, something filling, something that won't leave me craving junk food throughout the day, so that my mind is sharp and that I am able to engage in high-level decision-making from the start of my shift to the end of my shift. And I notice a huge difference if I eat something, you know, like, let's say a slice of pizza at lunchtime. I'll feel terrible by 3 o'clock. And you cannot engage in the challenge that is being a physician if you are not taking care of yourself first. And so I'm very thankful for the habits that I learned as a kid that I've carried on throughout adulthood, because while residency is going to be challenging in terms of hours and in terms of losing a lot of the flexibility I have over my life. I hope that I'm able to hold on to what I've learned so that I can educate my patients and help even my colleagues to live a healthier life.
Terrific. I think you will do well. A couple of tips from an old physician. Residency in a couple of months, residency will be much more hectic than medical student life. So I'm just telling you. And a couple of tips. During your day, when you are extremely busy, you will try to refocus yourself several times a day. So between your patients, between patient rooms, you will take this deep breath breathing techniques, even for several seconds, 4, 7, 8 breathing between the patient's room before going to the next patient's room. Okay. You will close your eyes, you will refocus and take 4, 7, 8 breathing once or twice before going to the next patient room. It will refocus you immediately. When you take a quick bathroom break, going to the bathroom, this is your space. You close the door. You're in that room, you're by yourself. This is your quick time to refocus. You can even quickly meditate. You close your eyes. You can even turn the lights off. Stay in that room for 2-3 minutes and refocus, meditate, take deep breaths, and this will rebalance you for the next hour or two. And take those breaths in between patients. This will keep you going through the day. Okay. And do the same thing before going to bed, breathing exercises, meditation. And during your driving, when you drive in the morning to work and from work, don't listen to any podcasts. Don't listen to the radio or music. You know, just meditative driving. That's what I call meditative driving. Just focus on the birds, on the scenery around you. Look at the cars in front of you, acknowledge their, you know, the color, their size, their shape, and pay attention to the road and just meditate while driving without falling asleep. So that's the best, just quiet driving without getting into a car accident. But I'm just saying that don't get extra, you know, noise or this, you know, input. Any sensory input, just get some rest while driving. I have one last question for you before we wrap up, and it's a short one. The leadership, you are a natural born leader. You've been on the leadership of the board of the American College of Lifestyle Medicine. Where do you see yourself in the future in terms of leadership within the medical community, leading the lifestyle medicine cause? How are you going to do this as a female, young female physician?
I love this question because it makes me feel excited and hopeful for the future instead of dreadful. So I love this question. Thank you. But I think first and foremost is where I chose to pursue residency was very intentional. So the University of North Carolina, their family medicine residency has the lifestyle medicine residency curriculum. And so while I will be in a separate residency, the combined internal medicine and pediatrics, I knew that I would be going to an institution that values lifestyle medicine, because they would not have implemented the LRMC if they thought that it wasn't something that was worthwhile. And so UNC provides a lot of opportunities for their residents to grow both within their leadership skills, their advocacy skills, all while becoming an adequate clinician. And so I plan throughout residency to use my months that are meant for my own professional development to engage with the lifestyle medicine residency curriculum within the family medicine program so that I can hang on to what I am passionate about and hopefully start to build the groundwork for what I will need to become certified in the future. But while I'm doing that, I think my main interest and my main scope is going to be within medical education. You know, it was my dream during medical school to create a lifestyle medicine elective, which you very kindly volunteered to speak for. And we successfully finally were able to do it this past semester. And it was a huge success. There were 80 people at the Grand Rapids campus, and we had a quarter of those people signed up for the lifestyle medicine curriculum. And that means that there is a need and there is a demand for this knowledge and this education early on in your medical training. And so I think what I want to do over the next 4 years and for the rest of my career is really learn how to be an effective, not only clinician educator, but a medical educator, and how I can integrate my knowledge for basic science and clinical science with my passion for lifestyle medicine and curricular change on a medical education level. And I think UNC, where I'm deciding to pursue residency, is going to be an excellent place to do that, because they not only care about training you to become an effective doctor, they want you to become a leader, they want you to become a researcher, they want you to become an advocate, because it will ultimately just benefit patient care and our communities as a whole. So I'm really excited for the next few years.
I'm so excited for you. And you know what? I'm pretty sure you will reach every single point you're aiming for, and you will do so amazingly well, because you're so driven. You're such a bright, you know, personality, and you're just such a sunshine, and you're a wonderful person. It's so smart, and you will get whatever you want to be. Annika Linford, I'm so, so grateful for you to be here with us today. Thank you so much for your time, and I hope that you will aspire so many young medical students and physicians to go into lifestyle medicine as well.
Thank you so much for having me. It was great to talk with you, and I can talk about this all day long, so it was nice.
Thank you for your contribution to the field of lifestyle medicine as well. And for all our listeners and viewers, thank you so much for being with Cardio Seeds podcast today. And we will see you at our next episode. Thank you. It was your host, Dr. Svetlana Shimon, and goodbye for today.